So how did it go this week with the green wristbands?
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Several times I looked at that wristband and was reminded, oh yeah. Yeah, it's my words and my actions that are bringing Jesus to life. Bummer, that probably didn't bring him to life. So keep that wristband around and reminding you as we push ahead in this series. A couple of years ago, the Chicago Tribune ran an article. It began this way, quote, "For nearly 40 years, Ted Neely has been Jesus. He's lived him. He's breathed him. He spent nearly his entire lifetime researching him. You see, since the 1970s, Ted Neely has been playing the part of Jesus in the popular musical Jesus Christ Superstar." And in an interview with the Tribune, Neely said something I think is really interesting, worthy of our consideration as we push on in this series and talk about bringing Jesus to life. He said this, and I quote, he says, "I'm only playing Jesus. Jesus got it right the first time. I'm still working on it, you see. The key word there is playing. I'm a performer. I'm pretending to be someone that I am not." And that is exactly what we don't want to do in this series. Wouldn't you agree? We don't want to pretend. We want to go further. We want to, as fully devoted followers of Jesus, bring him to life so that he actually comes to life in us. That his presence, which is, of course, his spirit in his people, that his presence will be known and experienced by others when they are with us. No matter how good of an actor Mr. Neely is, I'm pretty certain that no one has ever come away from watching that musical thinking, whoa, I forgot for a few minutes that I really wasn't with Jesus. No matter how good, it's a performance. It's only a performance. And as we continue, my friends, in this series, learning to bring Jesus to life, we must remember this. If Jesus is going to come to life in us and through us, one thing is very certain. Performance won't do it. Performance won't do it. Just saying the words, going through the motions, isn't going to bring Jesus to life. And that may sound a bit like a contradiction, because last Sunday we talked about the necessity of our words and our actions giving evidence that we are followers of Jesus, that we will in fact live our lives in a certain way. You remember Jesus' question, Luke chapter 6. He asked those who were around him, "Why do you call me Lord and not do what I say?" We talked about that in terms of living in such a way so as to show that what Jesus taught really is important. That Jesus really did mean for his followers to do what he said. He really did intend for them to obey his commands and to follow his life's example. And so, are you thinking at this point, well, then what is it? Is it our words and our actions, or is it not? We can't have it both ways. Well, I want us to be able to answer this question this morning and to understand what is it that makes the difference between words and actions that are just a performance. Words and actions that just make us actors in this drama of daily life, versus words and actions that really bring Jesus to life to those who are around us. Let's watch this DVD clip together.
It's funny to think about it now. And it wasn't that long ago, but when I was younger, when I was a kid, I used to run. I used to run everywhere. Something in me, I wouldn't stop. I ran to my parents, I ran to my bed, I just ran. I think we're all sort of like that. We're You're all on fire for life with no responsibilities, living. I'm excited to get places. And then at some point, I stopped. We all stopped. We just started walking. We started coping, getting comfortable, getting content. We were no longer on fire. We were no longer passionate. There was no longer the burning desire in our hearts. But we kept walking, fitting in. And you can call it whatever you want. Proper, easy, normal. But it all just seems so boring. Is this what it was about? But maybe we need to get passionate again. Maybe life isn't about being comfortable or content or making it easy. Maybe we're supposed to be different and be passionate, not lukewarm. Maybe instead of walking around and being normal, we're supposed to be radical. Maybe we're supposed to run.
Maybe, just maybe, as followers of Jesus, we're supposed to be running. Maybe there's supposed to be a passion and a burning desire in us that pushes us, propels us through life and into the lives of those that we are with. Running like we did, so many of us, as children. Enthusiastic, excited, taken away. Last Sunday, I suggested to you that if we are serious about following Jesus, then I really think that we need to quit calling ourselves Christians because the term has lost its meaning. Because for so many people in our society, Christians aren't people who run. Christians are people who just live their lives like everyone else. That is not what Jesus intended. There is far too much confusion in our culture as to what exactly a Christian is. So my recommendation throughout this series and for the rest of our days together, let's call ourselves followers of Jesus. They are people who run through life. They are people whose words and actions are filled with a passion. They are radical. Followers of Jesus do not want to settle for comfortable and easy because the stakes are far too high. People need to know Jesus. People need to know Jesus because their eternity hangs in the balance. And the way that people are going to know Him is to see and experience Him in those who call themselves His followers. Those who are running. I read an amazing story this week. Some of you remember the early 90s. There was incredible gang violence in the Boyle Heights section of East Los Angeles. There were 8 gangs in conflict. And in particular, around this one place, the Dolores Mission Catholic Church. Killings and injuries happened on a daily basis. A group of women who met for prayer together read the story of Jesus walking on water. Then, one of the women, who was a mother, was just so electrified by this text that she began to identify the parallels between the story of Jesus and her own story. That night, 70 women began a procession from barrio to barrio. They brought food with them, guitars, and love. By all accounts, this was weird. They ate chips and salsa, and they drank Cokes with gang members. They began to sing traditional songs together. The gangs just became disoriented. They were baffled. One writer says, the war zones were silenced. Each night, the mothers walked. By nonviolently intruding and intervening, they broke the rules of war. The old script of retaliation and escalating violence was challenged and it was changed. It's no accident that the women christened their nighttime journeys love walks. And as the relationships between the women and the gang members grew, the kids began to tell their stories. Anguish over lack of jobs, anger at police brutality, rage over the hopelessness of poverty. And together they began to develop things like a tortilla factory, a bakery, a child care center, a job training program, a class on conflict resolution techniques besides killing one another, a school for further learning, a neighborhood group to monitor and report misbehavior, and much more. The presence of Jesus came into the barrios and life was changed. Now, rarely does that kind of a story make the news. But that is an amazing example of bringing Jesus to life. Those women aren't Christians as our society understands the term. No, those women are followers of Jesus. My friends, the difference between words and actions that are simply a performance and those words and actions that bring Jesus to life is in one word. Passion. Passion. Plain and simple. It's a passion that burns in the gut of those who are followers of Jesus. And followers of Jesus are passionate about the things for which Jesus was passionate. It's that passion. It is that passion in the gut of a follower of Jesus Christ that will bring Jesus to life, not only in his followers, but in the lives of those who are around his followers. Does this make sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay. I need four readers. I need four volunteers. I just need four of you each to read a couple, three verses from John. Who would read John 4, verses 32 to 34? Volunteer? Don't shy. Jeff, great. Just put your finger in this. We'll come back to these in just a minute. So, Jeff, you've got John 4, 32 to 34. Somebody, I need you to read John 5, verses 19, 20, and 30. Volunteer? All right. Donna, John 5, 19, 20, and then verse 30. Somebody read John 6, 28, 29, and 38. Sharice, good. John 6, 28, 29, and 38. And then finally, I need someone who will be ready to read John 8, verses 16 to 18, and 27 to 29. Brave soul, Jason. Great, thank you. John 8, verses 16 to 18, and then verses 27 to 29. Okay? So put your fingers there, and we'll come back to those in just a moment. Okay. I want you to turn to someone nearby and ask them, what was Jesus' greatest passion? We know about Jesus, right? We read about him in the Gospels. We've studied. We've heard sermons for years, many of us. What was Jesus' greatest passion? Ask someone nearby what they think. What do you think? What was Jesus' greatest passion? Okay. What do you and your neighbor think? What was Jesus' greatest passion? Does it seem a little audacious of us to classify a greatest passion. Ellen. To do the will. It does. To do the will of him who sent me. And him would be who? Okay. To do the will of him who sent me. That's it. We can go home. What else? What else? Anything else? People. People were a great passion of Jesus. I saw a hand. Funny. Great passion. Absolutely. Okay, good, good, good. Anything else? Yes? Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, okay. Good. Any others? Gary. To do his father's will here on earth. Huh. Who else? Diane? Show us the Father. Is that what you said? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Good stuff. Let's hear from our readers. Okay? Jeff, you have our first one? Okay, from John 4. Can you stand and read it out loud?
Sure.
Thanks.
But he said to them, "I have food to eat that you know nothing about." Then his disciples said to each other, "Did someone have rotten food?" "My food," said Jesus, "is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work."
Okay. Yeah, conversation with the Samaritan woman. That's probably familiar to many of us. Yeah, disciples went away to get food, came back, and thought that Jesus would be hungry. And he said, no, I have other food that you don't know about. To do the will of him who sent me. Okay, how about our next reader? Who had the next one? John 5? Donna. Oh, Rick's got a mic for you. Thanks.
Jesus gave them this answer. "I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. Yes, to your amazement, he will show him even greater things than these. By myself, I can do nothing. I judge only as I hear, and my judgment is just, for I seek not to please myself, but him who sent me."
Great. Thank you. Did you hear that? He was being criticized for doing miracles on the Sabbath. Jesus says, "I'm just doing what my Father wants me to do. I'm doing what pleases my Father." Okay. Who's our third one? John 6? Chase. All right.
Then they ask him, "What must we do to do the works God requires?" Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." And then down to 38, "For I have come down from heaven not to do my will, but to do the will of him who sent me."
Okay. I've come down from heaven to do the will of him who sent me. And last, John 8. Jason, John 8, 16 to 18, and then 27 to 29.
"But if I do judge, my decisions are right, because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your own law it is written that the testimony of two men is valid. I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me." They did not understand that he was telling them about his Father. So Jesus said, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one I claim to be, and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me. The one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what pleases him."
Okay. Jesus had been criticized and asked questions about his authority. On whose authority do you do this? What, you know, where's the testimony to validate who you are? Jesus says, "My testimony is the Father, and I'm here to do what pleases him." So, with those words in our ears, let me ask you again, what was Jesus' greatest passion? And all of the things, the other things that we mentioned, those certainly were under that category of the will of his Father. If it wasn't, he wouldn't have done them. Because he says, I have come to do my Father's will, to please my Father, to do only what my Father has given me to do. You get it?
Yes.
Is it clear? The life that Jesus lived, His words and His actions, everything that we know as Jesus, everything that we understand about Jesus, everything that we glean from reading about and watching the life of Jesus in the Gospels, everything that He said and did flowed from His relationship with His Father. Flowed from the Father through Him into the life of those around Him. You remember last week when we recalled the words of Jesus regarding what is required of those who want to be His follower? Jesus says, anyone who wants to be My follower must do two things. Remember, the first one was deny themselves, and the second one was okay, and when you've done that, Jesus says, then follow Me. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and then follow after Him. Now, to deny myself, we know, is to be intentional about living as if my needs, my agenda, my desires are unimportant. I need to follow Jesus. I need to follow after Jesus so closely that I become like Him. His desires become my desires. His needs are my needs. His agenda is my agenda. I am His. I am His follower. And taking up the cross, that's pretty self-explanatory. Unfortunately, it's not the jewelry. It's the instrument of death. Take up the cross means that I will suffer for Jesus. Followers of Jesus will suffer for Him. Now, I was struck with something this week. And you're going to go, duh. I've never seen this like this before. Self-denial, and taking up the cross are exactly what Jesus did. This is where you go, duh. But wait, I understand the cross part of it. I understand that the cross was in some ways the climax of his journey to earth on our behalf. But listen, the cross was only one day out of His life, albeit a very important day for which we are eternally grateful. But it was only one day. Self-denial characterized His lifetime. Jesus, by His own words, didn't do things that He wanted to do. He didn't say things that He wanted to say. He did only what was the will of His Father. He lived for His Father. Self-denial characterized His whole life. I don't know where I've been. It just jumped out at me. Jesus lived for the glory and the honor of His Father. Period.
Right.
Do you remember the story? Luke chapter 2. It's one of those brief childhood glimpses of Jesus, age 12. Mary and Joseph had traveled to Jerusalem for the Passover. Passover is over. They're on their way home. Assuming that Jesus is in the entourage, He's not. They've lost Him. They return to Jerusalem. And after 3 days of searching for Him, they found their 12-year-old son in the temple. And when they found Him, do you remember what He's just like? Son, where you been? We've been worried sick. Jesus' response to them at 12 years old was, why were you searching for Me? Didn't you know I would be in My Father's house? At age 12. At age 12, Jesus was passionate and understanding of the relationship that He had with His Father, and He lived for the glory and the pleasure of His Father. Now, let me ask you a really important question. What does that say about the nature of God as Father. Jesus was passionate about His Father's glory. Lived to do the will of His Father. Lived to please and do only what His Father gave Him to do. Say only what His Father gave Him to say. What does that say about the nature of God as Father and the fact that no one knows the Father better than Jesus? Now, let me ask you another question. How do you know the Father? How well do you know the Father? I know you thought I'd forgotten. Let's stand and read our text. Just a couple of verses that need to jump out at us. We'll do more with this in the coming weeks. From 1 John chapter 3, let's read together. See what great love the Father has lavished on us. Okay, wait a minute. The word lavished would imply abundance, generosity, in incredible gift, excitement, extravagance. Let's try that again. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. Dear friends, now we are children of God. And what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. All who have this hope in Him purify themselves just as He is pure. Everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that He appeared so that He might take away our sins. And in Him is no sin. No one who lives in Him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen Him or known Him. My brothers and sisters, the word of the Lord. Go ahead and be seated. John ends with one of those statements that always gives us great concern. You know, man, he says, if I live in Him, if I'm really in Him, then I won't keep on sinning. I won't sin. And it's language, my brothers and sisters, of relationship. How did John start this passage? How great is the love the Father has lavished on us? That's not a question, although it's a good question. How great is the love that the Father has lavished on us? But it's a statement of wonder. It's a statement of amazement. How great is the love of the Father that He's lavished on us that we should be called children of God. I like what Peterson says, what marvelous love the Father has extended to us. Just look at it, he says. We're called children of God. And that's who we really are. Now, here at Applewood over the years, we've talked much about being the children of God. We understand that God loves sinful, rebellious people, and He makes them His children. He adopts them into His family. We're pretty astute theologically. We understand things like adoption and redemption and justification and atonement, all very important concepts to our faith. But here's the truth. I don't think theology lights the passion in your gut. Sometimes it clears the cobwebs in our brains, but it doesn't light a passion in our gut. Relationship with God as Father lights a passion in our lives. It's interesting to me that Jesus didn't speak about His Father in lofty theological terms. Spoke about His Father in words of intimacy and closeness and oneness. One of the things in John 6 that got Him in big trouble. You know, the high priest tore his robe over the fact that Jesus said, the Father, Yahweh, and I, we're one. Whoa! Intimate relationship. He lived the life that he did, obedient and committed to pleasing his Father because of who he knew his Father to be. My brothers and sisters, we've talked before about the process and what it means to become the children of God. Where I want us to go in this next week or two is to understand, what does that mean on a daily, practical, emotional basis? What does it mean to be children of God? And I think that if we can begin to understand the wonder, the amazement, as John expresses it, the love that the Father has lavished on us and continues to lavish, if we can work to put aside our imperfect understandings and experiences of what a father is, if we can push through to really grapple with what Jesus has said and what the Scripture teaches about God as our Father, I think that there is great potential for a passion to come bubbling out of us. As followers of Jesus, we share the same Papa. You look pretty excited about this. Praise team, come on up and prepare to lead us as we respond this morning. I have an assignment for you this week, if you'll choose to accept it. You have the old Mission Impossible tape, you know. In Luke chapter 15 is the story of what we often refer to as the prodigal son, the lost son, the rebellious son, you know, the son who trashed his father's reputation. Would you try to make a point to read that story every day this week? Read it again. Think about it hard. Ask the Spirit of God, who is the one who opens our minds and our hearts to the truths of Scripture, what is it that Jesus is getting at in terms of the Father? What does that mean to us, not in lofty theological terms, but in the practical, day-to-day, here's where I live my life as one of God's kids? Read it every day. And come prepared next Sunday to talk about the practical wonder of being God's children. Just let that sit in your heart and bounce around in your head all week long.